your cargo space, a CVT transmission, and up to 32 mpg. Details at TyndallSubaru.com. This is WFAE News.
Support for NPR comes from Performance Bicycle, bikes and gear for all styles of cycling, store locations, and an online store at performancebike.com.
This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. The Catawba River has been designated as one of America's most endangered rivers three times, in 2000, 2008, and again in 2013. We're number five this year. That's down from number one in 2008, so I guess you could say progress is being made. But just 2 years ago, the Union of Concerned Scientists listed the Catawba as the fourth most stressed river in the United States. When you consider that 1.7 million people in the Charlotte region, which includes North and South Carolina, depend on the river for life, these statistics are nothing to sneeze at. Attention must be paid, and one of those paying attention is the Catawba Riverkeeper. Now, this is where it gets a little sticky. I was going to say, as of today, Sam Perkins is the Riverkeeper, but that's not true yet, but it may happen during the course of the program, I'm told. He is Director of Technical Programs at the Catawba Riverkeeper Foundation, and moments from now, the announcement could be made that he is the Riverkeeper. He's here to give us the State of the River Report. Welcome to the program. What is going on? This has never happened before, where a title might change during the show.
It's all a matter of formality.
Okay. So you're about to become, one would presume, the Riverkeeper, and there are people out there who may not be familiar with the Riverkeeper and the whole idea of a Riverkeeper. We've had your predecessors on this show, beginning with Donald Lisenby, who I believe was the first Catawba Riverkeeper,
yes,
if I'm not mistaken. What's a Riverkeeper? What is a Riverkeeper organization?
There are about 200 Riverkeeper organizations worldwide. There's even Riverkeeper in Iraq for the Tigris and Euphrates, but they are dedicated to a specific river basin and dedicated to the protection of that river basin's water. And the Catawba River Keeper has been around since 1998. We're in our 15th year. I think one thing that really sets us apart is that we have an incredible volunteer network that's extremely helpful. So it's a network of eyes and ears that we hold trainings for, but that is extremely helpful for helping to identify a lot of the problems in our basin where DENR, the state regulatory agency, might not be able to.
So this is a non-governmental body.
Right. We are a 501c3 nonprofit.
And what's your background that made you interested in doing this for a living, and also, and I guess you do it for, I guess you get paid,
yes,
and qualifies you to be the river keeper?
We are membership supported off of generous donations, and we have three full-time employees. My background, my mother was a scientist, and, you know, we always were outdoors. My family's from the mountains, so always outdoors, always around water, always happy to see it on a long camping trip, so I was born and raised in Charlotte, went to grad school after undergrad at Chapel Hill, and studied the Haw River there, and really fell in love with studying water.
So you have a scientific background in this, I guess, what I'm
yes,
saying.
Yes. In 2011, I finished a master's in geochemistry and hydrology.
Okay.
At Chapel Hill.
But you're a non-governmental organization, and you do keep tabs on what's going on, and you're kind of a watchdog for the river, and you do bring up things that you see that are going awry and things that are going well, but you have no real power. Is that true?
It's true. We don't have any power. We don't receive government funding. We don't have government authorities, but we certainly try to teach people how to be the eyes and ears to supplement and report to government agencies.
When and how and where did this whole idea of river keepers, not just in Charlotte and the Catawba River Basin, when did it begin?
Actually, in the Northeast, with the Hudson River, with a lot of the problems with PCBs up there, there was a seen need for citizens to get involved, because the Clean Water Act in 1972 really did have provisions that empowered citizens, and this was sort of the vehicle for utilizing that, the Riverkeeper model.
I mentioned all of these statistics at the top of the program. We were America's most endangered river, one among them at the top of the list in 2000, 2008, and 2013, and then the Union of Concerned Scientists have put us as the fourth most stressed river in the United States, and there are other statistics that I could have cited from various different sources. These different sources, are they all just nonprofit organizations that monitor the health of rivers, or some of them governmental organizations?
These are other nonprofit organizations, and what they look at and what they see in us is a very small river basin. I would encourage people to look at a map of the river basins in North Carolina. And you see we have a very large population and a very small drainage area. And, you look at other river basins like the Yadkin-Petey or the Cape Fear, they're huge river basins. But we have—
Geographically speaking.
So yeah. We've put a lot of people in a tiny area, so our problems accumulate and run downhill and collect in water very quickly.
I actually looked at a bunch of maps yesterday, and I was— of course, everything is at a different scale when you look at maps, but you think of Lake Norman as being this enormous body of water. You look at it on a map, it's not that big, and Mountain Island Lake, which is where Charlotte gets its drinking water, in comparison to Lake Norman, looks like a pond.
Yeah.
Is that what you're saying, essentially, that we have all these people living around these relatively small bodies of water, taking water out, using it for recreation, using it for power generation, et cetera?
Absolutely, and that's one reason why water quantity is our biggest long-term issue. And a lot of other people like our water, so we have a big problem with interbasin transfers. People to the east, you've heard about it maybe with Union County, wanting our water because we do have a plentiful, relatively clean amount of water coming down from the mountains,
right.
And people want that.
We'll talk about quantity in a second. I know that you've just returned from Washington where you testified before the EPA mm-hmm. on effluent guidelines. It's a pretty word for sewage,
yeah.
Sludge. In other words, you're talking about sludge. Sludge is the byproduct of sewage treatment, correct?
Yes, that was one of the aspects of the effluent limitation guidelines. Really, you hear about NPDES permits, which were something that is required for any discharge, and NPDES stands for National Pollutant Discharge Elimination System, and the goal originally was to eliminate all pollutant discharges, actually by the mid-80s, when the Clean Water Act was passed in 1972. And so this was a hearing kind of aiming at getting toward zero discharge from pollution sites.
And how are we doing?
We have a long ways to go. There actually has not been much in the way of reductions, but this is, I think, one of the biggest steps that we've ever seen toward that, because some of the provisions that the EPA has proposed in these guidelines would include zero discharge. So, if you generate waste on site, you keep it on site. You do what you want on your property, but you keep it on your property.
If the goal was the mid-80s to have this
yes.
happen, and here we are in the mid-2010s, what is that, 30 years?
Yes.
What's taken so long?
Politics. it sounded great and easy at the time. You would think in the Nixon era, if you could get something like the Clean Water Act passed, then it should be easy to keep that momentum up, and it just, I think, we really started to realize how much we were putting into our water and how difficult it was going to be to start to curtail that.
Well, rivers used to catch on fire in this country.
The Cuyahoga.
Cuyahoga. And I remember having grown up in the D.C. area, you didn't want to be anywhere near the river on a July day because
right.
it just stunk. It doesn't anymore. So obviously we've done a decent job of cleaning things up, correct?
Yes.
And we never had severe problems like that on the Catawba, ever, did we?
The Catawba has had issues. The textile industry, there's a laundry list of industries that dumped chemicals in, they truly weren't limited, so there was no reason not to. And but even urban creeks, I think one of the best examples is Little Sugar Creek. I grew up around Freedom Park, and, that used to be a horribly nasty, stinky creek, and mm-hmm. geese were not the only source of it. And you would never want to go in and play in it. And it's not perfect now, but the engineering that's been done to clean it up has made it worlds better.
So what are the primary pollutants that are going into the watershed or going into the river, the Catawba River, which also includes mm-hmm. the Lake Wylie and Lake Norman and I guess Mountain Island Lake's part of that mm-hmm. system. What are the pollutants and who's putting them in?
The most pervasive is sediment. That is the biggest issue. That's just dirt. It fills in the lakes. It clouds up the water. It makes it difficult for fish to breathe. But it's also a transport vehicle for the more specific chemicals that you typically hear about. And, you know, those are things like arsenic and a number of other carcinogenic metals that come from places like coal ash ponds or other industry discharges. PCBs are probably the biggest legacy contaminant, and that's why we have our fish advisories out on the lakes.
On Lake Norman, why are there PCBs in the water?
PCBs were something used in transformer oil in the electric industry, and it's been difficult to track down point sources now, especially since some of these sources may have been flooded under the water when the lakes were created. But
so it's that old? The source could be that old? Because the lakes were created, what, the turn of the 20th century?
The oldest lake is actually Lake Wylie. It was first created in 1904 and then again in 1916 after a flood. Norman is actually the youngest. Norman is celebrating its 50th anniversary this year, but still, it's a legacy because these don't break down in the soil.
And these transformers that you're talking about, the power companies no longer use them.
PCBs were banned in the 70s, but again, they don't break down, so they're still an issue.
One of the other things that I was actually surprised to find, when we go back to talking about what's in the sludge, that is the byproduct, the waste product of sewage treatment, I always thought that once it went to the sewage treatment plant, although I wouldn't want to play around in it, that it was relatively innocuous. It was benign. It was you spread it on farmland and everything was fine. You could use it as fertilizer. But you say that it contains everything from contraceptive hormones to anti-seizure medications and other chemicals and metals. That stuff isn't filtered out somehow?
One of the biggest issues that we see building is pharmaceuticals. And I would first and foremost encourage people, if they have expired or extra medication, not to flush it down their toilets and go to a medicine drop. Sheriff's offices will take them, or we have events for dropping them off where they're appropriately dealt with, mainly incinerated. But the water treatment plants are not equipped to handle these. And
Why not?
They're pharmaceuticals. They pass through our bodies. You know, they're not all absorbed.
That was my other question. I don't want to get too disgusting about all this, but people take a lot of medication.
It's a fact of life.
And it has to go someplace, and once your body has used it up, it goes where everything else your body uses, and it gets flushed down the toilet. Is that part of the problem as well?
That's a large part of the problem, and I think one of the biggest issues in, you know, trying to understand, you know, why aren't we filtering this out? Why aren't we even testing for it? We're not even really testing for it, is because you think of how many molecules have been created, especially over the past 20 years with the pharmaceutical industry. There's no magical machine where you can pop in a sample and it tells you every atom, every molecule. It's just not that easy.
But this sludge doesn't get pushed back into the river. It goes elsewhere, doesn't it?
It does, and a lot of Charlotte-Mecklenburg sludge is taken down to South Carolina and spread on fields there, and we use what is called a Class B sludge, which means it's allowed to have a lot more bacteria than a Class A sludge. So you're talking, instead of 1,000 bacteria or less per gram, 2 million or less per gram.
And why are we allowed to have that, and why does South Carolina accept it and then spread it on whatever they spread it on?
Well, there are nutrients, and the farmers get free nutrients out of it, and it does help complete a nutrient cycle, but the problem is everything else that comes with it, from pharmaceuticals to metals.
Because I know that there's one county in South Carolina, that will not allow it to be spread on.
Well, that was one example. Chester County, for example, they receive a very large quantity of Charlotte sludge, but they won't allow their own sludge to be spread. So it's kind of ironic, but you know, they have concerns over the industrial chemicals in their own sludge.
We have to take a break. Sam Perkins is about to become one, by the end of the show perhaps, the Catawba River Keeper. We'll continue our conversation in just a moment. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Charlotte Speech and Hearing Center, providing hearing solutions since 1967, offering patient care and technology to meet any lifestyle, connecting people to the sounds of life. CharlotteSpeechHearing.com. And the Gay Men's Chorus of Charlotte, presenting Big Gay Country, celebrating country's support of the LGBT community, tomorrow at 3:04 and 8:04 at CPCC's Tate Hall. Tickets at gmccharlotte.org. In April, an elderly couple died in a Boone hotel room, and in June, an 11-year-old boy died in the same room. It was after the boy's death that authorities determined the cause. In both cases, was carbon monoxide poisoning, raising concerns about why the facts didn't come to light sooner. And in fact, there have been troubling problems in the medical examiner's office for years. We'll talk with two reporters who have been looking into this Monday at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, the Friday News Roundup. House Republicans overwhelmingly resist a comprehensive immigration overhaul. President Obama's nominee to head the FBI answers questions about domestic surveillance. And the Boston Marathon bombing suspect pleads not guilty.
Join the Diane Rehm Show for the News Roundup this morning from 10 to noon after Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the health of the Catawba River today with Sam Perkins. He's Director of Technical Programs for the Catawba Riverkeeper Foundation. And by the end of the show, maybe named Catawba Riverkeeper. It's a long explanation, which we don't need to go into. Several years ago, we had one of your predecessors on to talk about the health of the river and the result of the long-term drought that we had been going through. And the levels were down. They were way down. Duke Energy was, I think, a pretty good steward of the river in keeping the levels up enough for water consumption. That's the primary goal, I guess, more than boating, although boating and recreation is a good thing, and so is power generation. But now we have exactly the opposite situation going on. We've had extensively heavy rains, which continue. What's the impact of the river on the river and the lakes of all of this rain?
Well, first and foremost, after any rain, it's not a safe time to boat or swim, but it's it floods the lakes with sediment, with bacteria, and I think really what all this flooding has shown us is the need for better stormwater management, for stormwater ponds, especially on construction sites. We really need strong regulations in place to make sure that when we get this slug of water day after day, that it's at least having time to slow down and not hit the river so quickly.
But on, you know, construction, although we do have a lot of construction, it's not as extensive as all the stormwater sewers that are on all the streets in town that I understand right. Just go from the sewer system right into creeks and streams and then right into the river, correct?
Correct.
So is that really going to make a dent in anything if you have a storage pond for construction sites to let the sediment settle if all the other stuff is just coming right from the streets into the rivers?
Oh, it still makes a huge difference. Some of my research in grad school, I took sediment samples around construction sites, and you had 1,000 times the sediment concentration off of construction sites relative to elsewhere.
Really, because that's just dirt. Off the streets, it seems to me, it's dirt, it's pieces of brake fiber, it's oil from engines and gasoline and the oil from the tarmac, etc.
Which is all the more reason to have it filter through something and have it be taken up in a drainage pond as opposed to hitting the creeks in a big slug. The other problem when it hits the creeks in a big slug, a big spike of water, is that it starts to erode the banks and add sediment.
Okay.
Water wants to carry sediment, and it'll find it somehow.
Your organization points out that the dams along the river were built very early in the 20th century or the mid-20th century when the population was considerably smaller and development mm-hmm. had not grown to the degree that it takes place today. A lot of natural areas since then have become paved over. They've become parking lots. They've become pavements. They've become sidewalks, etc. And there's no place for rainwater to go. It can't sink into the ground as it could when this was just a forested location. It goes right into the streams. What does that mean for the health of the river?
Well, again, it's rinsing off chemicals that you don't necessarily want in your waterways. And, you know, to give you an idea, 1 acre, 1 inch of rain over 1 acre of impervious area is 26,000 gallons of water. And that's all hitting pretty immediately. It's the epitome of a frictionless plane, the way it's hitting the water.
You mentioned these construction ponds to hold rainwater runoff. Mm-hmm. New developments also, I think, have to – if you build a new housing subdivision, you have to have a retaining pond. And many people don't know that the band shell at South Park on that little body of water, that little body of water is the drainage pond for the parking lots there to allow sediment to settle before it travels out elsewhere. But you say that there are efforts in the legislature to weaken the requirements for these ponds.
Right. Charlotte and other urban areas have developed better tailor-made sediment and stormwater control measures that really fit this city, this region, and there are measures in the legislature. It was Senate Bill 612. It's now, I believe, Senate Bill 112. It's been reintroduced. The language has that would allow the legislature to say the state is going to set a standard, and the local municipalities are not allowed to have anything more strict or more lenient. So they are setting basically what the standard will be.
And what would the impact in Charlotte be of that, given the standards that they want to set?
It would set us back a number of years, really a number of decades, because it's taken a while to really, tailor it to the needs of Charlotte. And if you think about it, someplace like Asheville up in the mountains is not going to have the same stormwater needs or issues as somewhere on the coast like Wilmington.
And what's their reasoning for wanting to do this?
I can't really speak too well to that. I've heard streamlining government, making it easier to understand, more consistent, certainly from county to county. But, the truth is, we have different needs and issues than, even Raleigh.
So I was going to say something that I shouldn't say, so I won't say it. One of your most serious long-term concerns on the river, and you brought this up early in the conversation, is quantity of water. We have never had to think about that very much in the United States, water quantity. But as our population grows, we are experiencing shortages already in the West, and they're coming east. They will be coming to the Catawba River Basin?
They will be coming. I mean, they came in 2007, 2008, and, of course, right now, I'm sure people are rolling their eyes at the thought of a water quantity issue, but you look at it long term, some of the water studies that have been done, including by Duke Energy, have said that we're running out of water, and by 2048, we will have demand exceed supply.
So what do you do about that?
Well, you need to look at who is consuming the water, and the largest consumer of about half the water is power plants using water for cooling.
But isn't that a loop?
That is a loop, but the problem is when water is used for cooling and put back in the lakes, it's warmer, it's more ready to evaporate, and so that's one area of loss. Agriculture is another, and of course our direct drinking water consumption is still a significant enough portion, but I believe only about a quarter of the pie.
I know that one of the things you can do is require efficient use of water, and you can link growth decisions. These are your ideas. Link growth decisions to water supplies and support rainwater capture. These were three recommendations that were put forward when Mike Easley was governor. Have they taken place? Have they changed since then?
They have and haven't. I mean, truthfully, the biggest issue that keeps coming up for really directly taking water, not through loss of evaporation, is interbasin transfers. Water that leaves our basin for use in another basin and does not come back. Mm-hmm. And we've been watching in Union County, North Carolina, Lancaster, South Carolina. There's a project down there that would like to take millions of gallons a day out of the Catawba River that will not come back and leave less for folks downstream. And so it's issues like that. That's one reason there was a Supreme Court case in 2010. Reasons like that are one of the biggest threats.
And what kind of steps have been taken with regard to rainwater recapture? I know that during the drought we had lots of discussions about the old days, the 1930s, when people had rain barrels in their yards and they would capture the rain in culverts and things like that. And we could do that again today and use it as gray water and flush our toilets with it if we wanted to redo our houses with a whole separate plumbing system, or certainly water our gardens and our lawns with it. Have we made any steps toward that at all?
Rain barrels have become immensely more popular, and in fact, we're going to be giving away 15 of them thanks to Coca-Cola. The bottling company up near Mountain Island Lake actually uses the old syrup barrels as rain barrels. They repurpose them So there are a lot more programs today out there to get people to install them in their spouts, but it's something that still needs a lot more work, and really on the larger scale, we need it for managing stormwater off of the streets.
I know that individual usage of water has climbed a lot in the last 50 years. We use more water than we did in 1950, each of us individually every day.
Right.
And people, and we've done a show on this too, people don't realize that most of the water they use is not from bathing, not from drinking and cooking, not from flushing the toilet, not even from watering the lawn. It's from turning the power on and off.
Right.
How can that be?
Well, again, because when you have either a nuclear plant or a coal-fired power plant, you're generating that electricity through the generation of steam. And in that cycle, you do need cooling water. So you're taking water in at a certain temperature, and then you're putting it back in the lake at a higher temperature, and it evaporates. And so you do lose that water, and it's not available downstream.
But here's where we get into a sticky wicket.
Right.
You have to have water to live, period.
Right.
That's a fact. But in a modern society, you have to have electricity, because I don't think any of us wants to go back to the 19th century.
Right.
So what do you do about that? How do you supply the electric power needs? We've already had Duke Power, it's the predecessor to Duke Energy, build these dams on the river, which have created these lakes, which generate power and provide power, water for power generation in the good times, and provide recreation and provide drinking water, etc. And they've been pretty good stewards at I hope you'll agree with me here, that everything I've read says that Duke has been pretty good stewards of keeping those lakes available for all the purposes that I just mentioned, even in the dry times, right?
In general, yes. And in fact, I'll even say one of Jim Rogers' quotes that I'll absolutely agree with is, the cleanest power plant is one that we never need to build. And so it is on both sides, needing to tell people that if you want to save water, turn off your light switch.
So how? Well, that's my question.
Yeah.
How do we have a burgeoning 1.7 million population region that requires a great deal of electric power and have clean water at the same? How do you balance the equation?
Well, renewables certainly are part of that equation, and that's something that, you know, there certainly talks about with the rate hikes getting implemented in a bit more, and we would like to see implemented more, certainly. But it's also people, you know, realizing that their electrical use is depleting our available water. It really is a message. A lot of people just don't even understand that basic aspect.
Duke Power, or Duke Energy, is a kind of steward of the Catawba, considering the dams that they operate for electric power generation, and which created, as I've said, both Lake Wylie and Lake Norman. A tricky job, it seems to me, managing water levels and supply for power generation and recreational and drinking purposes. And along those lines, they've been given, as we said, fairly high marks. But you have other points of view, Sam Perkins, and a number of concerns about things that Duke Energy may or may not be doing that harm the river, may or may not be harming the river. And we wanted Duke to be with us for this part of the conversation, to have some time to address those concerns and give us their point of view. And to that end, we've invited Aaron Culbert, who is Duke Energy's communications manager, to join us, because we're about to get into some things that may not be totally fair unless we have both sides of the conversation represented. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Nice to have you here. Duke Energy released a statement about the American – well, let me go back to the American Rivers Report, which we really haven't talked about. According to your website at the Catawba River Keeper, Mother Jones listed the Catawba River as one of the 21 most vulnerable rivers in America based on a report by a conservation group called American Rivers. The reports in 2012 and 2013 on which rivers face the greatest threat. So we're among the 21 most vulnerable rivers. Why? What was in that report?
It was in the American Rivers annual listing in 2013. They cited us as the fifth most endangered river for water quality reasons because of coal ash ponds, specifically on Mountain Island Lake. And now that River Bend has closed, and that's great news for air quality, we are concerned about the waste that is being left on site, because I don't think a lot of people in the city have a concept of what these coal ash ponds are. They are waste lagoons that are 80 feet high, 71 acres for the one on River Bend. They're unlined, and the way I always describe it is like mashed potatoes on a plate above our drinking water reservoir holding back a toxic gravy. And they are leaking, and that's one reason we have filed our lawsuit. They don't have the appropriate monitoring to them, and we've documented some pretty concerning chemical levels in
now,
the lake.
Now, Duke Energy released a statement about the American Rivers report, saying it is disappointing that American Rivers and its partners continue to bait the public and play on emotions to further their own agenda. This does nothing to serve the Catawba River. While they focus on promoting unfounded gimmicks, we will continue to collaborate with the 18 public drinking water utilities along the river who are taking real action to protect our water supply for this and future generations. That's from Duke Energy. Are you saying that they're wrong, that they are lying at American Rivers?
Well, Mike, I think it's important to recognize that the data that Duke Energy, but not just Duke Energy, our state regulators, other agencies have, does not show any evidence of a water quality crisis in the Catawba River Basin. You know, Sam's exactly right on a number of points, and I'm sitting over here nodding because I think it's important for folks to realize that Duke Energy and the Riverkeeper Foundation share a lot of the same objectives. Certainly, we all want to have clean water. Certainly, we have very high stewardship goals in mind. And I have to say that from my position and the different organizations that I've worked with in the area, I have a different perspective. I'm very optimistic about the way that the Catawba River sits today and the future of it because there are so many people that are really working very hard to care for it. I would put our two organizations at the head of the list. We've got marine commissions that are actively engaged. We have a lot of individuals. We have, of course, the 18 large municipal water suppliers that make up the water management group that are engaged. So a number of these issues that we're talking about, including water quantity, water quality, have a lot of the best minds in the region actively participating to protect the river basin.
Well, getting back to this American Rivers report, because the words that you folks used in your statement, what do you mean by bait the public and play on emotions and to forward their own agenda? What are those three things refer to?
Many of the organizations that are critical of Duke Energy's coal operations have an end goal of reducing coal as a fuel source. And certainly that is an activity that Duke Energy takes to heart. We have made a lot of progress in that area. For example, since 2005, our mix of generation has reduced in terms of coal from 62% to 44%. Our natural gas has improved from 6% to 25%. So we have done a lot to clean up our power generating system by modernizing our power plants, investing in natural gas, investing in cleaner coal technologies. So I think it's really important to put a lot of this in perspective because many times, while we know, and even Sam has mentioned this morning, that nutrients and sediment are the biggest threat, sometimes it's just easier to focus on those point sources like the industrial sources for fundraising purposes.
Do you take issue with that? Obviously you must, Sam.
Well, our end goal of a cleaner river, that is our agenda. I'll readily admit to that. We may see different routes to that
Well, is it easier to focus on industrial pollutants as opposed to sediments, which you yourself have said are the biggest problem out there? Is it easier to go after the people who put chemicals in the water and who may be...
Oh, we actively balance point and non-point sources. I mean, we are actively engaged in the nutrient criteria planning that is currently going on in the state that would set some nutrient standards. But, point sources are just, they're easier to identify, and they are point sources. And if those are sources of carcinogens or problems, why not target those?
Are you pleased with or willing to recognize that Duke Energy has made improvements in the last 20 years toward reducing their impact on the river?
Oh, absolutely. I would even note a few of the areas where they have made particularly good progress. Cliffside, for example, they've lined their waste lagoons there for coal ash. And they've put some scrubbers to improve air quality, but matter's not created nor destroyed, so we're concerned about where that goes, and right now it's in the water.
We have to take a break. We'll come back with more in just a moment. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and dermatology, laser, and vein specialists of the Carolinas welcoming Dr. Olson and Dr. Kazari to the practice, providing state-of-the-art skin care to the Charlotte region. Details at carolinaskin.com. DianeReem.com. It's Friday. That means the weekly news roundup on the Diane Rehm Show, the domestic hour first and then the international hour at 11. At 10 o'clock, House Republicans overwhelmingly resist comprehensive immigration overhauls. President Barack Obama's nominee to head the FBI answers questions about domestic surveillance, and the Boston Marathon bombing suspect pleads not guilty. Those are among the stories they'll be talking about. We, of course, are talking about the Catawba River, and we will continue our conversation in a moment. If you'd like to join it, WFAE.org/Charlotte Talks is a good way to do that. We're coming right back.
Snap judgment from NPR means your mother, your kids, the dog, and your boss are just going to have to wait until the story is over. Join me, Glenn Washington, for Snap Judgment.
Snap Judgment.
Storytelling with the beat. Do not miss it. Snap Judgment. Saturdays at 8 p.m. or Fridays at 10 p.m. on WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Sam Perkins is Director of Technical Programs at the Catawba Riverkeeper Foundation, and sometime today will likely become the Catawba Riverkeeper. I would say it's 99.99% certain. Aaron Culbert is Communications Manager for Duke Energy, and we're talking about the health of the Catawba River, which supplies 1.7 million people with drinking water, recreation, and electric power. And electric power is what consumes a lot of the attention of the Catawba Riverkeeper organization because it has an impact on the river. Charlotte, Mecklenburg, Gastonia, and Mount Holly get their drinking water from Mountain Island Lake. Duke Energy's Riverbend Power Plant has coal ash ponds near Mountain Island Lake. If there is a danger from these ponds, as Sam asserts, and from coal ash certainly itself because of the chemicals in the coal ash, why did Duke Power ever locate these ponds near the river, and why were they allowed to do so?
Mm-hmm. Well, first of all, Mike, I think it's important to really point out that Duke Energy, but also very many other state and other agencies, do water quality sampling in Mountain Island Lake and in the other reservoirs in along the Catawba. The sampling that we've been doing in Mountain Island since 1953 has been very stable over time. You know, we have permits to be able to discharge water back to the basin. Those are under limits that we have to comply with.
And the water that you're discharging back, does it come from those coal ash ponds?
It does. Riverbend Steam Station, before it retired, had two active coal ash basins. Those have certainly been a long-standing technology that was used many, many years ago. But I can certainly tell you that coal ash basins is an outdated technology, and that is precisely the reason that Duke Energy has already invested millions of dollars to convert some of the larger stations to a dry handling method that no longer uses ash basins.
And you closed the Riverbend plant. It no longer is making electricity.
Correct.
Therefore, there's no new coal ash being created.
Correct.
But the ponds continue to exist. Was that the plan?
Well, certainly coal ash ponds served a wastewater treatment function for many years. It handled that ash safely, but now we are working on a long-term solution. You know, certainly Duke Energy intends to close those ash basins, not just at Riverbend, but at the other six sites in North Carolina where we have closed coal plants. You know, Duke Energy, by the end of this year, will have retired 7 of our 14 coal plants across the state. And the reason that we've been able to do that is because we've been able to make the investments to build replacement power through cleaner and more efficient stations and other types of renewable sources of energy. So the long-term solution is to be able to close those ash basins per state and federal regulations, and we have a very top-of-mind focus in making sure that we pick a closure method that is suitable and appropriate and provides that long-term water quality protection, and we'll intend to do that.
You talked about how over the years since 1953, your sampling has shown that there's not as much impact on the river as some might believe, but the Catawba River Foundation says that a recent sample of pond leaks on Mountain Island Lake found high levels of barium, chromium, lead, selenium, and arsenic, all of which are associated with coal ash waste. Duke Energy says that some seepage from these ponds is actually necessary. Why?
It is. Seepage is a natural function of a healthy earthen dam. And I know that seems sort of counterintuitive. It's not unique to coal ash basins. It happens with hydro dams as well. But in order to relieve pressure that could build up inside the dam and cause a structural integrity problem, some amount of seepage needs to flow through. And keep in mind that it's a very minimal amount. You know, we have permits to be able to discharge from the ash basin outfalls, larger volumes, and it's the same water quality that's coming back.
Duke says the volume of ash basin seepage is, quote, extremely small and has negligible impact to the overall water quality in Mountain Island Lake. What does that mean, extremely small?
Extremely small. Well, the reason that we know that is because of the water quality sampling that we do. You know, we can certainly demonstrate through longstanding data that the water that is upstream at downstream our stations is a very good quality. You know, you can look for arsenic, selenium, mercury in the water a very short distance downstream from our stations, and it's non-detectable. And it's certainly not detectable by the time you reach those water intakes
downstream.
Let me
come back to you then, Sam, because you say you found high levels of these chemicals in the water. What does that mean, high levels?
I would say that we've tested, Mecklenburg County has tested, and also the state has tested, and the state, you know, found levels that concern them as well, both in the seepage that, you know, it's kind of a question of extent where we take the issue. There's enough of it to be four streams that are not part of the MPDES permit, and so that's why we're calling them illegal
MPDES
discharges.
MPDES is what?
That is the permit system for point discharges, and they're not being monitored. And the question is, what is the law with regard to
not
that?
Not being monitored by Duke Energy?
Duke Energy.
Does it matter as long as the county is monitoring? I mean, you guys are monitoring. Does it matter?
The county's not monitoring. I mean, the problem is it's on their site. I've, you know, accessed everything up to the high water mark to measure these, and we have found levels above the state and EPA allowable levels. And I think maybe the easiest way to summarize it is that Jim Rogers himself in Charlotte Magazine's May 2013 issue said, you know, he agrees we are going to probably end up needing to clean up the Riverbend coal ash site. So, you know, it's kind of the pack in, pack out concept of leave it as you found it.
You also estimate that the four seepage collection systems which Duke has built collectively have a flow in excess of 400,000 gallons per day. Would you agree with that?
You know, Mike, I think it's important to keep it all in perspective. You know, when Riverbend was operating, for example, it was permitted to discharge about 4 million gallons a day from its ash basins.
4 million?
4 million gallons a day.
So this is 1%.
It's a very small percentage.
Or is it 1% or 10%?
10%.
Excuse me.
And, you know, and I'm not even sure that I would exactly agree with their estimates. But certainly we all can agree that it's a very minute amount.
Well, I was going to ask you, if you would just for a moment agree with their estimate of 400,000 gallons a day, what makes that small? That sounds enormous to me.
It does. And keep in mind that it all is in a matter of the units that you're talking about. You know, when they talk about arsenic levels or selenium levels, they're talking about parts per million, parts per billion. You know, in parts per billion.
But this isn't our drinking water. This is not just in some pond someplace.
You're exactly right. And that's why we have so many resources employed to make sure that the overall health of the lake remains very good. So there are all sorts of opportunities to monitor before that water even goes downstream to those water
intakes. When the water is taken out of Mountain Island Lake and goes to our taps, it goes through water treatment. Does the water treatment at CMUD, I guess they're in charge of, yeah, of course they're in charge of treating the water before we drink it. Does it filter out all of these nasty chemicals?
If I may, Mike, the one thing that's important to note is that we do monitoring even in the raw water before it reaches their intake, and there's no trace metals detectable even before it goes to the treatment
plant. So where are these trace metals being detected?
They're sampling right at the ash basin outfalls.
Yeah.
Meaning what?
Well, no, the places where you don't find them detected as much, and I would get into an issue of how often you're sampling, is by the intake grates. having tested, and this is not just us, this is also Mecklenburg County, having tested by the outfall, we have found levels above what the state and the EPA regulatory levels are. And I mean, you know, some of those, it's parts per million or billion, but that's all it takes with long-term exposure, which you would get from your drinking water reservoir, to cause things like cancer. And you know, it's not just on
These have been linked to cancer, learning disabilities, neurological disorders, birth defects, reproductive failure, asthma, and other illnesses. So who decides how much of a risk is worth taking?
State regulators have the responsibility of doing extensive calculations and monitoring to issue the appropriate permits. So that is something that is built into the regulatory system of our federal and state governments. Certainly, Duke Energy is the regulated utility, so it is then our responsibility to do the monitoring and the reporting and the compliance of those permits that are in place.
And we've found for Duke's own groundwater monitoring wells, the levels they've reported, especially for manganese, which is a big neurological issue, we have found levels above what the state regulators have set. There are state standards, and we have found up to 128 times the level of allowable manganese in the groundwater.
It's also too important to remember that iron and manganese are naturally occurring. So even in places where you're not seeing the impact of a potential ash basin, you're also going to exceed iron and manganese at those levels.
When you retire these coal ash ponds that we're talking about at the old River Bend plant, what happens to the coal ash in them?
Well, that's exactly what we will be exploring. We're going to be bringing in consultants, not just for River Bend's ash basins, but for the other sites across the state that we'll be closing as well. We're certainly going to be closing those ash basins per state and federal regulations, but there's a number of different methods, and so we're exploring all those methods to see what's the most appropriate way.
If these ponds were to disappear tomorrow, if the active ponds were to go away, and if the coal ash were removed from the River Bend ponds, would there be a pollution problem that you could detect coming from Duke Energy?
If the ponds were taken away, that is the source, that's what's steeping like tea, it would be significantly reduced. And it would certainly not be there for our future generations to clean up. There has been a lot that's built up in soil. We have found approximately 220 times more arsenic in the soil downstream than we have upstream of the River Bend steam plant.
The North Carolina Department of Health and Human Services Division of Public Health recently issued the first fish consumption advisory in Lake Norman because of PCBs. They're telling you not to eat the fish. There are communities that get their drinking water from Lake Norman. And I understand, I think I'm right about this, that Lake Norman is upstream of Mountain Island Lake, which is upstream of Lake Wiley. And other municipalities get their water from Lake Wiley. So if there is a PCB problem that they're telling us not to eat fish caught in Lake Norman, aren't those PCBs filtering into Mountain Island Lake and into Lake Wiley and into our drinking water?
PCBs actually move around very differently than some of the other metals that we're talking about here. PCBs are mainly built up in the soil, and they make their way up the food chain in fish. So the PCBs aren't really the same sort of a problem for drinking water intakes, but it's much more of a fish consumption issue. It builds up very efficiently in the fat of fish.
Yes, but if we're drinking the water and there are PCBs in the water, why aren't we taking those into our fat cells?
The PCBs we're not finding in the water. The PCBs are an issue more so in the soils. In the water, it's much more of an issue of manganese, arsenic. Cobalt is another one that we found 52 times what the regulated limit was.
In times of drought, it seems to me that these chemicals, whatever they may be and whatever their source may be, would be more concentrated than they are in times of plentiful water. And gosh knows we're certainly in a time like that at the moment. So is the problem worse now than it was during the drought, or is the opposite?
Typically during the drought is when you would see more of an issue, because another thing that we've seen with arsenic is that it's built up in the soil and there is activity going on that keeps it locked up. But when you get warm, stagnant, and not a lot of water, you get it released. And we've actually seen that in Charlotte Mecklenburg's drinking water sludge for what they treat and remove out of the water. We've seen higher levels of arsenic in that during the summer, and that's also where Mecklenburg County has tested and found higher arsenic during the summer also in the water.
We talked earlier about quantity of water and running out of water, the potential of running out of water. And I've forgotten the year that we're talking about the population level exceeding our ability to supply water. But you wanted to, I know that you wanted to talk, Aaron, about that a little bit from Duke Energy's point of view.
Yes, the modeling results that that Sam was referring to earlier, I think he had mentioned that, we were going to be running out of water in 2048. That's not really a correct interpretation of the study that Duke Energy conducted. That was part of the modeling work that we did as part of the Catawba River Hydro Relicensing Project. And so at that time, we determined through the computer inputs that we basically took historical weather patterns and moved them ahead 50 years to see what our operations would look like. In the last 50 years, we had a dry period during that time. So that simply moves that dry period in the model to that 2048 to 58 decade. Mm-hmm. It doesn't mean that we're running out of water. It's simply a temporary condition where we may have some capacity issues for one of the water intakes on the system. Now, certainly the year after we completed that study, we started reaching the drought of record. So we know that our water resources in the Catawba are very fluid, no pun intended. They're very fluid, and things can change them very quickly. So that's why it's really important to ensure that we have the stewardship and the regional water resource planning that Duke Energy and the Water Management Group are undertaking.
I have 2 minutes left, so I want to cover a lot of territory in 2 minutes. David emails regarding pharmaceuticals in our water supply. GE has a technology that can strip water down to the molecular level. This technology is very expensive. Intel uses it to create extremely clean water for producing computer chips. Municipal water utilities cannot afford this technology. Thus, we have all sorts of drugs in the water supply. You're also concerned, I know, about concentrated animal feeding operations along the Catawba River. Mm-hmm. Down east, where the swine ponds, effluent ponds, are kept, they now have to reveal where those ponds are. You're saying that the poultry producers in along the Catawba don't have to reveal what they're doing and where they are.
Right. We've documented a proxy. Because of that, we've looked at aerial imagery.
Excuse me. They use arsenic in the bird feed to clean out their digestive systems. Is that part of the reason we may have arsenic in our water?
Upstream, we've actually done some testing and not found a whole lot there yet, but that is mainly upstream and not in the what's draining into Lake Norman and Mountain Island Lake. But absolutely, those their biggest issue is a new potent nutrient source from not covering their waste.
So are you optimistic that we have a handle on this, that the water in the system is relatively healthy and getting better or relatively unhealthy and getting worse? What's your stand on that?
I would say we're increasingly stressing it. I would say that right now, you know, the water that comes out of your tap is safe to drink, that it's being adequately treated. But, you know, certainly we're a pond to fail, we'd have some other issue develop. The question is, would we be able to handle